Barry Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory Sports and Culture. We're brought to you by betonline.ag, the best place for all your sports, odds, information, props, and more, even your favorite Vegas casino games. It's all available on betonline.ag. NBA Finals coming to a close here over the next couple of games. You can still get odds and props for those games over there, but Stanley Cup Finals just getting going in the NHL. Baseball all summer long, soon going to be the big sport left, but always one of the most fun to bet. Good lines as well as money lines over there for those games, and futures for the MLB. It's all available right now on betonline.ag. Always tell you about their new website. It's not so new anymore, but it blows me away every time I go. All the different panels and sections and how easy it is to navigate. They did a great job with it, and it's my go-to place for information. If you're just looking for the top sports information right now, BetOnline is the place to go. And if you're interested in betting, go over there and use the code CLNS50. You're going to get 50% back on your first deposit. $100 gets you $50 back, free to bet. And you'll be on your way, whether it's the finals, Stanley Cup, fights even, always going on. There's always something going on in the sports world, and betonline.ag always has the latest information for you. Like I said, CLNS50, 50% back on your first deposit, betonline.ag, betonline, where the game starts. Here's today's episode of Dome Theory. Hey, Barry Manning here on a Thursday. Yes, that's right. We're losing track of the days, bouncing back between California and Boston, but back in Boston tonight for the NBA Finals, Celtics, Warriors, perhaps the last game of the NBA season, last chance for the Celtics to get it together, and for the X's and O's on how they're going to try to do that, Mode Dekeel is here, Bleacher Report, and his variety of video work, and of course, his Twitter breakdowns and everything else that he brings to the table. One of the best out there. Mo, been waiting to have you on here forever. Welcome to Dome Theory.
Oh, no, I'm glad to come on, and hopefully it's not going to be all doom and gloom.
I just hopped on my buddy's podcast, and I'm a pretty positive guy analysis-wise, especially when it comes to the Celtics this season in particular. But it's hard not to sound doom and gloom when you're talking about their offense sometimes. It gets ghastly. That's the only word I can use to describe it, especially the last two games here.
It's so weird because when it's going, it looks great. And there's, yes, you know, and you're like, wow, this looks unstoppable. This is amazing. And like, no team's ever going to stop them. They're just going to score 1,000 points. And then it just looks like, oh, we're never going to score again. Like it's such a drastic, like polar opposites. And in the way it kind of swings, it's actually one of the videos I did. I called it Jekyll and Hyde.
Yep.
Because that's really kind of what it is, you know, and they have two offenses, and one's really good and one of them is really bad. And whichever ones they stay in the most is usually going to decide the game.
Yeah. And the thing that worries me, and here we go, we're going to get negative right off the bat. I feel like, I don't know, I guess it's the Hyde. I figured I read that book in like middle school, but the bad side, whichever one that is, feels like more who they are at the core right now. And it feels like they're always battling, whether it's coaching, whether it's the sets they run, or even just the movements and everything else, that Rob helping it sometimes, some hot shooting at points. Those things sort of cover up what at its core, I think, is a flawed offense, whether it's the ball handlers that lead the way, not being the best at facilitating in the world. They don't have a lot of rim outlets as far as big men or even drivers go. Smart's gotten better at it. Rob's great when he's healthy, but that's always a question with them. And Horford, amazing. It's just not part of his game anymore, giving you those easy dump offs, rim looks, post ups around the rim. So what you're effectively doing a lot of the time is pick and pop, drive and kick, or some second level actions that get you great 3-point looks. But this is a streaky 3-point shooting team too when you look at their personnel.
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, their best offense is actually their drive and kick game. It's when they're putting pressure on the defense and they get a lot of different things. You know, Tatum gets off the ball quickly. Jaylen Brown's able to attack the the second side, and then from there kick it out, and then it's Marcus Smart driving in, and then they find open shots from there. And you know, that's really actually a great offense in general. Like when I watch and I go, oh, you got two paint attacks in one possession, like that's great, you know. And I'm not worried necessarily of them shooting late in the clock, but it's how they get to that. It's the offense when it's like, all right, we had one pass on this possession, Tatum dribbled for most of the possession, and then took a sidestep shot. Like, no pressure on the defense. We didn't force them to rotate. We didn't put them in any position to really have to defend. And I think those are the things that's challenging. I think when you end up in that scenario, and it, a lot of it is put on these guys, okay, well, they're going to have to make shots then, you know, and they're going to have to shoot highly efficient numbers if that's the offense you're going to run through. And it's hard to do. And listen, Wiggins has done a great job defensively. You know, Klay Thompson has done a good job helping, and he's done all right one-on-one. It's been up and down throughout the series, so you kind of just call it average. But ultimately, you know, you're letting these guys off the hook. You know, you're not attacking Jordan Poole when you should. Instead, you're attacking Nemanja Bjelica. You're not going at Curry as much as you should. And then sometimes you get so stuck going after Curry, you get away with what was really working. And I think there's just a lot of weirdness in the offense that they have, you know, because it's like when it's rolling, it looks great.
Yeah, and the drive and kick game you talk about there, the problem is, and this is really what ailed them at the end of game four, is that you're driving and kicking the Smart and Horford, who can be great through the flow of games, but when it comes to taking big shots, I'm not sure you want him firing off at three to steal a game there late, even though he is a good pick and pop big. White has just been a disaster shooting wise through his stint here with this team. So they don't space the floor well. They don't have a lot of great catch and shoot options. In fact, Jaylen Brown, I think one of the underrated things about this run is he's been a poor catch and shoot option for them throughout this run. I think that's limited what the connections Tatum and him have been able to form here. And then you talk about the mismatch hunting. It does feel at times like that breaks them out of that flow, or it takes them too long to get to those mismatches, or they're sometimes even screening Green onto Tatum and Brown and not really just aware of what's going on the court out there.
Yeah, I mean, it is a surprising thing. Like when you do go into run offense is basically my thing. Run your offense. Yeah. I think you can run just sets and you'll find everything you need. Smart on those kickouts, he doesn't need to shoot that. They're giving him space. Attack, like, right away. A lot of those times, especially late in game five, and we've seen it in other games, you know, there's opportunities where they kick it out to him. He's getting it with 10 seconds, and he feels like he has to shoot that. You know, and sometimes he does. Other times, drive it. Be the second driver in that instance and make the defense collapse even further and open it up. You know, with Horford, I'm okay with it. There was one at the end of game five game four that I wasn't really that happy with, but part of it was more just because Jaylen Brown had dribbled the entire possession going at Klay Thompson. Thompson stonewalled him, and it was almost just Horford had to shoot it more because Brown threw him a grenade, right? Like, yeah. I'm stuck, go, you know, and those are the stuff you don't want, even in drive and kick. So I think there's a lot of those issues that you're looking at. And I think that's something just within their offense, like, get into your offense earlier, make them defend longer, run your stuff, you know, show urgency offensively. Like, I had a conversation with a buddy of mine. He's like, the Celtics need to play faster. I'm like, they don't need to play faster in transition. They need to play faster in the half court, and they need to get into their stuff earlier and make the Warriors have to defend for 17, 18 seconds instead of just 11 seconds.
Yeah, and every team has to go through what they're going through right now. I guess you're either a team that's ball dominant, like the Mavs, or whatever LeBron team is, you know, going each year. Those teams, Harden's teams, that rely on one ball handler, one guy to create everything. It feels like Tatum could be that guy, but the Celtics have pushed against some of the worst tendencies of those kind of offenses by getting Brown involved as a ball handler, and Smart's had great stretches this year. More Brad Stevens-esque than I think people give it credit for. This team's an equal opportunity facilitating team, and it has its great moments and it has its shaky moments where you have 5-6 guys that could potentially facilitate here, and none of them are able to step in and make a play during the tense fourth quarter minutes here. Just how do you feel about the ball handling on this team? Tatum's made strides, Brown had his moments throughout the year, but his dribbling still seems to lapse and undermine what he's able to do as a playmaker. And then Smart in this series, more than anyone, I think, has been baffling with some of his decision-making. So you effectively have a team full of capable ball handlers, but none of them are able to solve the issues they have.
Yeah, and this is probably going to get me in trouble with some of the Celtics fans is, you know, they don't have the point guard, you know, and as great as Smart has been.
That's what it is, you think, huh?
Yeah, Smart's been awesome. Smart's been phenomenal, right? Like, has really done a great job in the second half of the season and for most of the playoffs taking that role on. And even though he played it in high school, even though he played it at OK State, it's not really his natural position. It's not that. Like, it's almost how different this offense would look if you had Ricky Rubio. And I'm just throwing Ricky Rubio out as a name. Like, it's not like, yo, they could have had him or anything like that. But just sort of that kind of guy that gets you into offense, gets you into the flow of things and understands flow a little bit better than those guys. Those guys just aren't natural playmakers. You know, we want Jason Tatum to develop playmaking. We want Jaylen Brown to develop playmaking. That's part of the progression for them. But their first thought needs to be scoring because that's who those guys are. They need a score. That's what the Celtics need. They need those guys to put up numbers. And I think that's one of those things. Then, you know, that's where you need that next playmaker. Like Smart would be great as your secondary ball handler. You know, the guy when Rubio comes off of a screen, I'm just throwing Rubio as an example and things, but he comes off a screen and then kicks it over to Smart. Now Smart can come off of a second screen. And from there, I trust him to make those decisions and things like that. There are times he just makes bad decisions. There's 2 threes in the third quarter of game 4. And these things just kind of stay with me. He took, you know, 2 off the dribble, step back threes. One was on Looney. And I can't remember who the second one was on, but they were early in the shot clock with 12, 11 seconds on the shot clock. And I'm like, those are the shots the Celtics can't have. And that's something that your point guard can't be the one taking. Like he needed to run offense off of that, attack Looney, and then find other opportunities or get a ball screen and get going. I think those are the things that you need to kind of get going. But the problem for me, the root of it is always going to be you really do need that point guard.
Yeah, and could it have been Derek White? Because when they acquired him, I don't know if I just didn't have good enough feel for his game or who he was as a player, but I felt like he was going to be part of the solution to that. It felt like he was a connector, a glue guy, someone who could ease them in those spots. But he looks as rushed and frantic as anyone out there when they get in trouble. And he's been another secondary guy when you talk about that role. It feels like he only touches the ball in the corner. He's screening now more often to get his hands on the ball, and that didn't work at all in game 5. Got swallowed up on those rolls. Sometimes he just looks like he's a catch-and-shoot guy out there, and he's a point guard by trade, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, I almost put him more as like he's a guy I'd want doing that off the bench. He wouldn't be a guy I'd want starting my offense and really to facilitate everything and go from there. I think those are the – and I like the trade for White. I thought that's going to be helpful. I thought maybe gave up a little bit too much in future draft assets, but you made it to the finals. So screw whatever the hell I've said, right? Like my analysis is useless at that point. He's there now. And I think the important thing is you need to have, he's just not that guy. He's not the guy that you can just say, hey, run offense for us for an entire quarter. Like, I don't think that's something he really could do well in San Antonio. I think he's a connector in the sense of like, he'll make the swing pass. He won't hesitate. Boom, swing it right to the corner. He'll do all that stuff. The things he needs to recognize, though, is when to, like, pull the trigger on shots. There was an example in game 5. He caught it on the wing, wanted to swing it, or first wanted to shoot it, didn't feel comfortable shooting, faked the swing, and that was taken away, and then finally shot. And I'm like, nah, you're not making that, man. Too many hesitations from you at that point. I think he's just not – he's a good piece off the bench, but he's never going to be that guy. That you need it to be a higher caliber guy. It needs to be Lonzo Ball would have been perfect, right? Obviously we know how that was kind of like almost prearranged for him to go to Chicago and all of that stuff. So we can talk tampering another day, but like along that line, right? Like that's something you need is a guard like that.
It's funny though. There's not a lot of those guys. And the two I love were of course Ball and Lowry, who ended up going to Miami. It's almost be careful what you wish for in those spots because both of them are obviously injury riddled now. And, you know, you don't know what they're going to be able to do health-wise going forward. Smart, Again, I love the strides he made this year. I felt Brown took strides in that area. That was Ime's mission statement coming in more than anything, I think, was developing all these guys playmaking. They all got better, but none of them coming up in the big moments here is disappointing. Tatum in particular, though, it feels like he has hope at that spot. And I've loved his passing since Duke. He was a great secondary playmaker there, I always thought. And early in his career, I thought he made some good reads rolling in other spots when he had the ball. And now, you know, whether it was the bubble and pick and roll action or this year being the point guard for most of the season on the ball, he's made awesome strides. And he quietly has 7 assists per game in this series, which if you were coming in, you said, that's great. He's doing a good job there. But everyone's looking at him saying, you got to play better. You need more from Tatum, scoring especially. And he just seems caught between passing and scoring right now, which that balance doesn't seem to come natural to him, but he's done a good job for much of this year. So what do you just overall make of his finals production?
I mean, I think his playmaking has been really good. I think he's been smart on getting off the ball quickly when the doubles have come and things like that. I think, you know, the ultimate thing is his 3-point shooting is amazing, but his everything inside the arc, you're like, what the hell's going on with these, right? And I think when you're watching those things, it's surprising, right? Like the mid-range shot's not falling. He's getting to the rim, but he's not finishing at the rim. It's so many different weird things with everything you're watching for. Like his finals have been very odd because we've never seen a guy that's just going to shoot this much better from three and so poorly from two in that instance. And the thing for me is he needs to make quicker decisions, in particular when he has Curry switched onto him. There are times he gets Curry switched onto him and he goes right away into attack mode. And that's perfect. That's what you want. There are times where he catches it and then he waits a beat or two. And that allows the Warriors to start loading up defensively with Curry switched. And now Curry has reinforcements almost behind him. And usually it's Andrew Wiggins hanging around somewhere or Otto Porter Jr., you know, Draymond at the rim and things like that. He needs to be a little bit quicker with his decision-making in terms of attacking, but I think his playmaking has been good. The most important thing, and this is across the board for everybody, is just for God damn, man, cut the turnovers down. Like they're trying to make plays that aren't there sometimes and they're just throwing the ball around. And I think that's the important, that's the thing everybody needs to watch for, right? I think the stat is they're, what are they, like 1-7 when they have 16 or more turnovers?
Yep. One win,
and,
yeah.
You know, it's like, and when they have less than that, they're like a ridiculous number. And I think there's just an impressive, it's impressive in that sense of like, that's so obvious to split. Like that's the difference in the series.
And they're obviously talking about that. I mean, you have 2 games in a row here where those have cost you. And they can't stop it. And I think that's everybody's question right now. The biggest question of all is why can't they stop those? When it's such an emphasis, when the record's split so far along those lines, it feels like they're still taking risks, despite that being such an overarching problem for them. Smart in particular, making some crazy pass attempts. But overall, what do you think is the biggest thing leading to those turnovers right now? Because it's not just this series. The whole run, they've been like a 13 and up turnover percentage team, and it's gotten worse every round.
Yeah, it really has been the entire playoff run. You know, I had somebody saying, oh, it's just the Warriors defense. I'm like, no, it's also Miami's defense, Milwaukee's defense.
It was bad against Miami.
Yeah, you know, it was just flying all over the place. I think part of it is that's where they're in their isolation stuff so much, right? They're doing all this isolation, then they get stuck, and now they have to force a pass somewhere, right? And the defense is able to kind of get a deflection and then get out running with all of those things. I think it's a lot of that stuff. And I think some of it is also just an inherent sloppiness, you know, Tatum bringing the ball up the court, and maybe it's fatigue. Maybe it's these guys are just exhausted. Like we can't discount the fact that they went through 2 7 game series now in a dogfight of a series here with the Warriors going to game 6. You know, it's just tiresome, you know, and sometimes it's just a lapse of judgment. And you know, the Warriors also are a high turnover team in general. They were phenomenal and took care of the ball in game 5, and that's, you know, what really kind of won it for them. But for the Celtics, it's when they're in that isolation stuff, I think they tend to find the turnovers a lot more. Like it would, as a video guy, I should probably go back and take a look and see how many turnovers when they run offense versus how many turnovers when they run isolation.
Yeah, and it's tough because if they lose this series, You're going to say great run. You're going to say they accomplished a ton this year. I think most people will be happy with the season that they had here. And you lost to a great team here that I underrated coming in, certainly, in Golden State. But these core issues, the ones that existed during their worst stretches, the 18 and 21 start to the year, being the same thing that knocks them out at this stage, that's worrisome to me. Because I feel like at the core, as you mentioned there, the point guard, I don't necessarily agree with that. And there's so few options for a pure point guard. Again, the fact that you have to mention Ricky Rubio in that role is a tricky thing because he's a guy that shoots like under 40%, and he'd be tough to play in his own right in a bunch of different lineups. But there definitely is something flawed here with this offense that it never seems to go away with them. And it's going to do them in here, it looks like. But to give the Warriors some credit, their defense, they're small. They don't have a typical rim protector, and they don't have elite perimeter guys. Maybe I'm underrating Wiggins, but overall, I looked at them coming in and said, is this really the number two defense in the league? Like, I just don't see it personnel-wise, especially when you have Curry and Klay to go after. But they've been that good in this series.
I mean, they've been phenomenal. I think there's the key to the Warriors' defense is the rotations and how sharp they are on a lot of those rotations, because they are generally small when you take away Wiggins and Thompson at the wing. Porter, okay, but he's probably more of like a 3-4 type guy for them. But like after that, like they're really one of their best defenders is Gary Payton II, and he's short, and he's ending up guarding a lot of, you know, bigger guys. And you know, he's done a great job actually on Jaylen Brown, stripping him a few times on drives and things like that. I think the thing for them is they do a great job rotating and covering for each other. And I think it all starts with, and even though he's been pretty bad in this series, has been Draymond Green, right? Like his ability to diagnose.
Defensively, he hasn't. He's been awesome.
No, he hasn't. Right. He's been great, you know, and he diagnoses the problem and prescribes the solution almost instantaneous. And it's kind of like, that's his skill, right? He has no real physical skill that's an advantage over anybody. It's just his ability to actually read the play quicker and react quicker than anybody else on the floor, and he's able to get there. There's an example, a buddy sent me a clip and we were debating whether this was planned or an accident, but Klay had gotten beat on a back cut. He got completely lost, his guy slipped, Draymond just immediately jumped off his guy and took the play away, and we were debating whether it was a switch or not because it looked so seamless from Draymond just sliding over. And I'm like, no, it was an accident, because you can see Klay's reaction. But the fact is, you can argue it's a switch planned because Draymond was already there. And I think that's some of the stuff that they do. Peyton's there ready to rotate. He goes in from help and then rotates back outside. Just so many different guys in that sense. And, you know, for me, you know, like I had picked the Warriors to start the series. I thought this was going to be a 70-game series. But it wasn't because of their defense. I actually thought my concerns were more because of what we talked about, Boston's offense at the end of games. But it's the Warriors' defense that it has been probably the most impressive thing for me in this series on their side of the ball.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that. And Boston's defense has been pretty good too. It's funny, Warriors offense hasn't been a problem here at all. When you look at the half court numbers, it's all these transition opportunities that have piled up on Boston from their offensive mistakes. But the one moment in this series I look at that's going to be a regret, and there'll be a lot of regrets here for the Celtics, because I think if they don't make it seven here, this should have been a 7-game series when you just look at the numbers and how even everything's been. It'll be because of one of the slip-ups in the last two games here. Last game, they were just a mess. That was the story of that one. But game four, Curry has this historic performance, and they're dropping on him. And I don't know if this is overthinking it. It worked, right? Because everyone else was getting locked up through four games. They wanted single coverage on Curry. They didn't want to trap, and they don't trap. So I get why you don't want to do something you don't do as a team. But he goes off for, I forget how many points it was in the game, just this ridiculous 43 performance, and you're dropping on him. And I'm talking to some of their coaches, I'm like, is that really a drop? Because they're at the three-point line, and I hear a bunch of people debating it, and they're like, yeah, that's a drop. And you're getting a little cute there, I think, right? If you're Boston's coaching staff, you're like, we're going to drop on Steph Curry. And I think you got exactly what you expect out of that result. He's raining, he's in a rhythm, and he's killing you.
And the worst thing is, one Curry gets in a rhythm, now it doesn't matter who contests the shot.
Yeah,
like if he gets just the slightest amount of space, because in that game four he hit a re- ridiculous three over Derek White, where I thought, like, yo, you can't defend that any better if you're Derek White, unless you're going to foul the guy. And I thought, like, you know, but he got in his rhythm and in his flow. And I've been screaming about their drop coverage from game one. You know, I just thought it was insane. I think the even with those guys being up a little bit higher, their first reaction when Curry comes off the screen is always one step back. And I'm like, no, it needs to be one step forward. You just don't let Curry shoot the three, you know? And I think that's kind of the issue there. But they're in a tough sort of, they're like in a rock and a hard place, because they changed their coverage in game five and basically were like, we're not letting Curry beat us. Let's see if the other guys beat us. But what that did was it opened up lanes for everybody. You saw Draymond with 8 points, and everybody's like, yeah, it's just 8 points. Yo, he was only getting two.
he surpassed his total in the first quarter, yeah.
Right. I mean, no, I mean, you think about it this way, right? He scored four times as much as any other time, you know, previous game. And I think the thing is the lanes opened up.
And Wiggins, and more, right?
Driving, like Curry's coming off the pick and roll and they're putting two on there. He's opening up the roll to Draymond, and Draymond finally took a layup, you know, the fake DHO into a dunk for Draymond. Like, all of that stuff stems from, like, hey, we're just going to completely take Curry out, and now let's play 4-on-4. Then Wiggins gets going, and, you know, Clay hits 5 threes in game five. Like, all of those guys got going. They're in that tough situation trying to figure out, like, how do we play this? You know, do we try to take Steph away? Or do we just let Steph score and try to just hope and make sure nobody else goes off?
Yeah, it's tough to nitpick, but the fact that they did switch it up says to you that they looked at it and said, all right, we got to stop doing this. We got to try something else here. And it happened.
It's hard.
Bob, it happened a little late.
The dude scores 43 on you. It's hard to go into the next game plan with staying the same, guys. Let's go.
I know, but they did some of this stuff against Giannis and Butler. Those guys were going off, and they said, we're sticking with this. We're going to let them get theirs, and everyone else is going to get locked up, and they escaped from those series, albeit in seven games.
It's funny because, like, everybody always kind of talks about, like, I have a buddy who's a diehard Celtics fan. He pollutes my text messages constantly with this stuff. And he's like, yo, but we were able to stop Giannis. We were able to stop Jimmy. I go, like, those are such different guys than that little baby assassin over there. Because that dude's going to be able to shoot the second he crosses half court. Giannis, you want him shooting threes, right? You're willing to give him a ton of space. Horford, you're going to give Jimmy space, right? That game seven, everybody, I thought it was a mistake that Jimmy pulled up for three in that game. Like, that's the shot Boston wants him to take. Curry, it's different, right? Curry's going to be a threat anywhere on the floor as soon as he crosses half court. And that's the difference between him and those guys. So that changes your defense and your calculus of how you defend him, and because it opens up so much more.
Yeah, and they did come into this series looking like they'd never seen the Warriors play basketball in their lives.
I was stunned. I was just like, you guys know that Steph Curry, right?
The
like
first that. Quarter of game one, I mean, and again, if that game goes a certain way, this series is over in five right now, but they had that great fourth quarter turnaround. But that first quarter, absolute disaster defensively, and they fixed it. But the way they were dropping on him really was hard to believe, and we'll see what they come out and do tonight on that end. It hasn't been their problem. They've defended well, especially in the half court. They're piling up stops. They're that Boston defense you expect them to be. They got to fix their offense to force a game seven here. And if you're them, what are you going to look to do to clean this up? I like some of the pick and rolls that they've done with Smart to get the ball in his hands close to the basket. I like Tatum getting off the ball at a halftime last game, although he's not always willing to do that. And I thought Brown might be a solution out of game four where he was so great, but then he's just a mess in game five. So there's no sure solution to what's going on for them offensively. But if you had to point to one thing that you think they should be doing more of to stabilize this offense, what would it be?
More movement off ball. You know, they were doing some stuff that was pretty clever of like trying to get Curry switched off of off ball actions, you know, and having, you know, whoever Curry's guarding go set a screen for Tatum, get the switch off the screen, and then go get the ball to Tatum and let Tatum go right away and attack. I think they just need to get more movement and more fluidity in their offense. You know, when it becomes very easy to defend with just a dude dribbling up the, you know, the top of the key, waiting for the floppy action to unfold with, you know, 11 seconds left on the shot clock. Like, you become easier to defend in those instances. They need to be quicker in the half court. And I'm not saying they need to run transition, although, yeah, it'd be nice if you got some transition buckets, but you got to be careful not to play in the Warriors' hands too much, because they want that game to be back and forth and fast paced. But you need to be quicker in the half court. and you need to get movements, cuts. Hey, if there is a guy up court dribbling, somebody needs to cut through the lane. Just move things around. You know, it's almost like just move the pieces on the board a little bit differently when that's happening. I think that's got to be the number one priority on their offense, besides not throwing the ball away to the other guys.
And I think that is another thing that confuses everyone watching this team is why are guys standing around and not active, not engaged? Brown, to me, he never sets screens. He's not an active off-ball mover, although he can be. And there's times where he gets lost, I feel like, just because he's not active enough off the ball. Tatum's gotten much better at that when it comes to cutting, screening and rolling or slipping in the mismatches. That's benefited him immensely this year. Other guys, it feels like, have a tougher time getting involved, whether it's Brown or whether it's Robert Williams, who I think I saw something like 13 shots total in this series for him. Something ridiculous like that, and he's had minute restrictions and everything else. But there are certain guys on the Celtics, Grant Williams included in this series, I feel like, who are just stagnant off the ball. And you wonder, you know, is that a coaching thing? They need to step in and get those guys into some sets to get them moving, or is that just on them to be active and creative?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, I think you need to have them, you know, the coaches kind of putting them in actions. You know, the start of game five, was, you know, of the second half was immediately, let's get into actions. Let's run. You know, I think they ran a go screen into a pin down to get the ball to Jason Tatum and get going. I think you just need to get different things, movement, just different stuff there. And that gets everybody going. You get those cuts and things like that from that. But also Grant Williams has to be better. You know, Peyton Pritchard has to be better. Derek White has to be better. You need help from the bench. Like, you're down to just playing five guys the whole time. And we know Robert Williams, who knows how healthy he is with that knee. Like, you need help from the bench. Somebody has to come off from the bench and be able to give them 20, 25 minutes and not take anything off the table while they're out there.
Yeah, some points. I mean, you think five deep rotation wise, they're really three deep scoring right now. Mm-hmm. When you think of Rob and Al not giving you much on offense either. So it's thin. It's getting thin out there. That's more the fatigue, I think, than the long run, is just them needing to put the starters in with 10 minutes to go in the fourth there and saying, let it ride. That wasn't going to end well there. And Brown and Tatum never sat in that second half. So this is too thin right now when you're looking at the Celtics, for sure. I guess the last one I got on this series is just the overall coaching, I'd say, matchup between these two coaches. I thought, maybe I just wasn't familiar enough with Kerr coming in, but I felt like Ime had the edge coming in with all the stuff he's done with this team defensively, getting the offense active in certain ways throughout this run. But Curry's been the better coach, I feel like, in this series, whether it's experimenting, different lineups, adjustments defensively, throwing different looks at the Celtics, Green on the ball some, Green help side some, and all the rotations help-wise that you're talking about. Like, they've been very active and aware on both ends of the floor. From the Celtics end, and I think this is a question everyone's had all season, is why doesn't Ime get more involved to stabilize the offense? And there's a quote that sticks with me from when they were terrible after that Knicks collapse, where he's like, do I have to call a timeout and just call a play and slow this down? And I think everyone was like, yeah, like, please do it. But the thing I've kind of gathered this year is he wants them to be more free-flowing, and he doesn't want to be a coach that's overly involved in the play calling. And I do think that confuses some people, but that just is how the league is for the most part now, isn't it? Like, it's really the players on the floor and the sets they've implemented directing things, rather than the coaches just piling down, playing or calling plays from the sideline, save for a few exceptions, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a, like, here's the thing for Ime. This is year one, right? Like, when you're coming in as a coach for year one, you want to set, like, your principles. It's almost like a plant, right? And you need to let it grow. And listen, in year one, going to the finals is pretty impressive. We've had a couple of coaches do this now. So it's not as impressive.
Kerr did it himself, right?
I mean, Kerr's done it. Ty Lue did it in his first year, you know, interim head coach. And granted, he had LeBron, but, like, you know, Nick Nurse did it. Like, maybe it's less impressive. Maybe I need to dial back the impressiveness of a first year coach doing it. But I think there's an element of, yo, he's still developing as a coach himself. He's still, you know, working with the guys, and the guys are still developing under him and those things. I haven't felt like either coach outcoached the other coach in this series. Like, I'm not walking away going like, oh, damn, Kerr completely outcoached Ime. Like, there is stuff Kerr has done where I'm like, you know, Kerr, Looney not playing, you know, or playing only 6 minutes in game three in the second half is absurd to me. Your best rebounder and you're getting crushed on the board and you don't play him. Like, there's things we can point to on both ends of these guys. I think
Iguodala at spots.
Yeah, I mean, just all sorts of stuff, right? Like, there's so many things you can kind of point to on both sides. I think the coaching has been fairly even on both ends, you know, and, you know, maybe next year we're going to see more offensive flow and more offensive principles from Ime in that sense. I think, and a lot of coaches tend to do this, you know, except for probably D'Antoni, but like everybody focuses on the team's defense first when they come in, because that's usually your root. And I think that's where they wanted to start out with. And, you know, now that they're in the finals, it's kind of like, okay, like what's going on with the offense? The microscope comes down a little bit closer to you. And now you get to kind of really dive into those things. The offense has looked very similar to the stuff they run with Brad Stevens. They've made some changes. They've tweaked a few things. The stuff, the adjustment of going off ball and getting Curry on the switches in the off ball actions before attacking has been good for them. And I think they've found some stuff, and we'll see what happens tonight in game six, you know?
Yeah. And I do want to get into some of your career, your journey to this point, because I love the work you do. I'm a big fan, and that's what we do here on Dome Theories. We get into a little of our guest journey here as well. Of course, Mo, a video coordinator in the NBA for 8 seasons, now with Bleacher Report, and, you know, associate head coach in that college. And the one season I'm going to hit on here, of course, timely, is 10-11 with the Spurs. Ime, a player on that team, right?
Well, I mean, it was, he had a short stint with us. You know, unfortunately, I was in the video room the whole time. I probably don't even have a lot of great Ime stories. I just remember, you know, the reference that he has with the team is, you know, like, or with the organization of the Spurs is just really important. Like, everybody talked highly about him. You know, he was with us for just about 20 games and things like that, and then ended up getting waived. The Ime himself, though, is just like, he's everything you see about him. He's just a dude that commands respect, and I think that's why you get that from the you get that from the players. Think about it this way: he was going into press conferences when the team was playing poorly and blowing them up, right? And it, almost to the point where I was like, all right, now this is getting out of hand, Ime. Like, what the hell's going on? You know, but the guys respect him enough to be able, you know, to kind of take it. We never heard any real problems in the locker room with guys being upset with him. I think there's a lot of just respect that he has, and this is respect he's had across the league and every stop he's been at.
Yeah, and it was a long and winding journey, cut various times. I think he had 2 knee injuries during his career too that kind of derailed him, and the amount of stops overseas and G League and different places in the NBA was pretty amazing. And then the long assistant coaching stint with the Spurs after that, and you know, then Philly and Brooklyn, and now finally getting his first job here. I think Spoelstra said during that Miami series, it was overdue for him to get this opportunity. And I've been pretty amazed by it as well. I love his demeanor in the press conferences, as you talk about there. It's great being able to get answers like those from him, but pretty candid and honest too in terms of what they need to do, his criticisms of them, and, you know, just overall the tone he's set from that position. Because you're right, it's been a lot of Brad stuff. I think that's been underrated, especially offensively. Defensively, I think he's taken them to another level on that end. But for the most part, he hasn't shaken the boat too much schematically. It's just been kind of the tone and the message in the room.
Yeah, I mean, that's been the thing. And I think that's the most important thing. You know, the thing is, the offense will settle itself out for the most part, yeah. You would hope, right? Like, you have two great guys in Tatum and Brown. You have Smart, which, you know, a little bit risky. Sometimes he's going to take some bad shots. Some of those bad shots are going to go in, and you're going to be like, okay, you know, he's definitely a candidate for the no, yes, okay, we'll take that shot type situation. But like, you got some good pieces across in that board. I think now it's just, now everything counts, right? Every possession matters, every play matters. So now we get to kind of focus in, going like, what are you doing? Like, yes, Ime, we do want you to call a timeout and draw up a play when the offense is struggling in those instances, in the finals, in game six, when you're back again. We want that. And I think we're going to see some stuff here. Like, I'm pretty excited for the game tonight.
So as far as your career, what got you into the NBA as a video coordinator? And I wonder just what goes into that. I'm sure a lot of our listeners and viewers don't really have an idea of what that job entails. Everyone's breaking down video on Twitter and YouTube and everywhere now. Is there a difference between what you see a lot of people do from a content standpoint and the stuff you're doing in your content now and just sort of what your job is in that role?
I think the presentation's probably a little bit different because, like, you know, look, I do it one more thing and I have like fire coming across. Like, I'm not showing that to Tim Duncan, right? Like, we're not showing him a video with like graphics of fire and explosions. It's a little bit different in terms of content with those things. I think the what got me in was, I mean, really two instances of just dumb luck. You know, I started out at junior college and the team needed a student manager, and I had a huge gap in my schedule. I had like one class I had to take, but it was like almost an evening class. So I had so much space. I was like, sure, I'll do this. It was just a hobby. I loved basketball. It was like, okay, cool, but I'm gonna be a nerd and study computer science or business or whatever I was majored in at the time. As you guys can tell, I probably wasn't a good student. And you know, I got hooked just being a manager and being around it again, being around basketball. And then, you know, I after a series of transferring schools, I end up at USC, and through my time at USC, I happened to walk into the basketball office just checking in one day, and they asked me to drive one of our guys to a workout, one of our senior players to a workout. And there I meet Neil Olshey and Tim Gergerich, who most people probably don't know that name, but he's like the godfather of player development. You know, go watch the UNLV documentary. He's got a ton of great Tark stories. But like, you know, those guys, I meet them. I spend the entire summer working out NBA guys with Neil and Tim. And, you know, after I finish college, I go coach a year at Santa Monica City College. And you know, Neil calls me up and says, I have a video internship. You know, would you want to take it? I jump at it. And that's how I kind of got in the league. It was a little bit of dumb luck, but a crap ton of hard work and late nights and just doing all the dirty work.
Yeah. What goes into it? You said you were in the room all the time. You didn't really get to be around Ime or that team too much. You just kind of hold away, like scavenging through everything and reporting at the end of the day.
Well, the truth is I'm 5'10", right? Like the other guys in the video room were like 6'6", 6'7". Like they were doing a lot of the workout stuff. I think like the one guy I worked out the most while I was with the Spurs was Chris Quinn. just because it was like, they're like, okay, well, Mo's small enough. like Mo can work him out. But the thing about the video room is we're responsible to making sure our coaches are prepared for scouts. And to build their scouting reports. You know, some teams have the video guys do some of the scouting reports, but you know, we're responsible for making sure every play is broken down, logged properly, ready to go. So if, you know, Coach Budenholzer comes up to me and says, hey Mo, we're playing the Bucks and I want to see all the pick and rolls, you know, on the left side when they're doubled, like, okay, cool. Boom. I'll have an edit ready to go and put that together and those things. You know, it's just a grind of you're just watching basketball nonstop. Like the funniest thing that people tell me is like, man, you don't watch basketball. I'm like, bro, I've watched more basketball in a week than you probably have, you know, in a year. And that's just in the video room. You know, you end up watching 3 or 4 games a day, breaking down stuff. And you, from there, you pick everything up, but it's a grind. You know, it's, I've slept in the office more than I would like to admit. I've done, you know, I had a pillow in one of my drawer cases. You know, you have a lot of that stuff and it's a matter of basically handling everything for the coaches, you know, in terms of making sure your coaches are most prepared and being on top of stuff of like, hey, if you see something that's random that, hey, they haven't ran this play a lot, but I caught this, you know, like we need to be ready for this play. You know, and being able to talk with your coaches and things like that, I think there's an element of like you're almost like an assistant coach, right? You're helping them, making sure they're prepared and putting together the game plan properly.
So yeah, you mentioned Bud, Quinn, you know, Vinny Del Negro. I know you were a big fan of working for him. Who's your favorite person you got to work with during your career in the league?
Well, two. One's pretty obvious, Greg Popovich. Mm-hmm. Like, Coach Pop's one of the best human beings I've ever met. Like, forget being, I think he's the best coach of all time, and I think he's a better human being than he is a coach. Like, you know, he is really amazing. And just, he showed me you can be more than just basketball 24/7, which is funny because I was still just grinding film constantly in the video room, but just showed me there's more stuff. You can be a more well-rounded person in besides just being a nonstop coach. And then the other guy who I absolutely love, and this is probably not great to say on a Boston thing because he was a coach in Philly, was Brett Brown. Brett Brown took me to Australia. Like, I got to go around the world because of Brett Brown and be part of the Olympics. Like, I had a great time with Brett, you know? So those two and Vinny. Vinny was just one of my favorite dudes to be around, you know? And I think that's the important thing, you know? He was just he's just a dude, and he would listen to anything that was said. So I really enjoyed, those were like my three favorite guys to get to work with.
And then were you there for the first year of Doc? I was trying to kind of lay that out with the Clippers.
I was there for the first year of Doc, and you know, Doc let me go at the end of the season. I earned that firing. I had a terrible year. I had a lot of like personal stuff going on and things like that, and it just wasn't a good match between him and I. But you know, like, Doc showed some stuff, X's and O's, that I was pretty impressed with in those things. But you know, ultimately, you know, he fired me, man. He ain't gonna be in my top three.
Fair enough. And then you make your pivot toward media after that pretty quickly. Tech as well, I see. Just what kind of led you into this field of putting your own content out there?
It was kind of funny. Doc let me go, and I was like, "Yep, I earned it. I completely wanted to get out of basketball, Bobby. I was done." I went and did tech staffing. I had a regular 9-to-5 job, was like, trying to figure out what a normal person does on a weekend. Cause it's video coordinator. We don't even have those most of the time. And you know, eventually realized how much I hated that. And then I had all this useless basketball knowledge kicking around in my head. Like, I'd watch basketball games with my friends and I'd point out a couple of things and they would all just look at me like, wow, okay. Like, you really do know this. And then I think finally I was just like, I got to get this out of my head. This is going to drive me crazy. So, you know, just started my own website. From there, my own podcast, was producing videos, and I've been lucky enough so far to continue that ride.
Yeah, follow him on Twitter. Follow all his content. He's one of the best followers you can get out there through the NBA playoffs, and of course, the draft coming up next week. I feel like I've like left the bar until like the last week before it's here. With this draft, I can't believe how close it is. I'm gonna like whoever gets called number one next pick. I'm gonna be like next week. I'm gonna be like, who? Like, that's how unprepared I am for the draft right now.
Well, let me just think about it. There's gonna be. I think we're gonna have a game 7 on Sunday, and then we're gonna have the draft 4 days later. So yeah, we're all cramming. Like, I don't watch college basketball. I'm trying to catch up now, but like, we're all cramming for the draft for the most part.
Yeah, I'll tell you this. It's a good thing the Celtics have the 53rd pick, and that's it. So that's going to give me even more time to prepare. He is Mo Dakil. Like I said, follow him at Mo, MODAKHIL _NBA on Twitter. And go read him at Bleacher Report, doing his podcast with The Athletic, and more twitching. And one more thing, which I love as well, the video series there on Twitter with the fire and the explosions and movie cuts. Appreciate you, Mo.
No, thank you for having me, Bobby. I'm glad to be here.